Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
You gotta move. When the Lord gets ready for you. You gotta move. Oh, you gotta move. You may be high.
You may be low.
You may be rich.
You may be poor.
When the Lord gets ready.
Ready for you.
You gotta move. Oh, you gotta move.
Our gospel reading this morning, which is from St. John, chapter 14, verses 23 through 29. Jesus answered him, "Those who love me will keep my word, and my Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. Whoever does not love me does not keep my words, and the word that you hear is not mine, but is from the Father who sent me. I have said these things to you while I am still with you, but the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything and remind you of all that I have said to you. Peace I leave you with. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not let them be afraid. You have heard me say to you, I am going away, and I am coming to you. If you loved me, you would rejoice that I am going to the Father, because the Father is greater than I am. And now I have told you this before it occurs, so that when it does occur, you may believe."
In this passage that Lori read for us, for me, it paints a picture, and I'm going to try and bring you in on my own imagination, which by all accounts is sometimes dangerous, so you've been warned. But, you know, it's Jesus with the disciples, and they are reclining after a supper. After a meal. And that was their custom. They didn't have chairs. And I know we've said that before, but just to get a picture, like leaning on and into each other. And where this falls in the narrative, they are doing so with freshly washed feet, all clean. And that was, I think, probably a surprise. Because never before had their teacher taken off his robe, or any teacher for that matter, and knelt down on the ground with water and a basin and washed their students' feet one by one. And for that matter, never before had a rabbi poured a glass of wine either. and said, "This is the cup of the new covenant poured out in my blood." That had never happened. They'd never been at a supper where their beloved leader had told them that someone among them in this small room was going to betray him, maybe more than one. And they hadn't been together in this way, I don't think, or I couldn't find, where he also kept saying to them, "Let not your hearts be troubled." But it's pretty difficult for me anyway to imagine a more troubling context for this. But I don't know, how do you hear that? I realized this week there are ways in which reading the Bible is almost like reading a text, you know? Because all you have is words. The Bible hardly ever tells us how a given line is spoken. Raise your hand if you've ever gotten in trouble for sending a text and they didn't know your tone. And they imagined the wrong tone through no fault of our own, right? They can't see our faces. We can't see theirs. The Bible really doesn't use a lot of descriptors. Like, it doesn't say, "He said sternly." I couldn't find that. And it doesn't say, "She whispered softly." You know? It doesn't say, "He muttered under his breath, 'I hope I'm not the betrayer. Hope it's not me.'" So, as I was reflecting on this passage this week, I need to confess that I'd never noticed that before. And further, until this week, and I'm 55, so that's a long time, I had always imagined Jesus speaking confidently, strongly, courageously, like bravely. But what if that's not the case? What if the words that Jesus spoke were done so with his eyes really wet and his lips trembling? What if his voice actually cracked when he was saying these things? Like any one of our voices might crack when we were trying to speak, maybe in a time we thought was coming to an end, like right the night before a funeral of a family member, when you're having that meal and getting the details straight, the story straight, and we're struggling to keep it together and to have this meal that's supposed to feel something special, and the moment kind of sneaks up on you and catches your voice, and it cracks. How do you imagine Jesus spoke these words? I would like us to hold that for a while. As I said in our opener, throughout the 6 weeks of Easter, we're in a series we're calling Tasting Resurrection, and we're trying to hold the Gospel of John in conversation with this documentary series on Netflix. And what we're hoping is that holding these in tension and reflection with each other will maybe somehow help all of us in our daily lives. And this particular passage that we have this week that Lori read for us, it falls within a sweep of chapters in the Gospel of John, you know, 13 to 17, that make up this gospel writer's version, his version of the Last Supper. And it's portrayed as a long, they call it a discourse, a farewell discourse of Jesus as he prepares his closest followers, his disciples, for the end of his physical life among them. And we're doing this because in our very first 2 weeks of the series, we exhausted any other resurrection passages that were in John's gospel. So now we're revisiting that last week of Jesus' life and that time before he takes his leave. And next week, I'm going to try and pull all of this together, and we're going to hear a prayer from chapter 17 that Jesus shares that recognizes the completion of his ministry. But today, this morning, we're hearing Jesus' expectations somehow woven in here. That the disciples will be obedient by loving him when he's gone and keeping his words. And maybe Jesus has a hope that these disciples are actually going to pull something off, you know? And so what he's doing is like recapping his own purpose and then offering through his words the presence of God that's going to be there with him for them after he's gone. I don't know about you, but that's not an easy thing for me to be obedient. That doesn't surprise you. In order for me to be obedient, I really have to trust the coach or whoever it is that has been teaching me. And then I have to find my discipline, my commitment to discipline. And then I think obedience on no small level takes spiritual fortitude to hold ourselves up in the midst of difficulty. So that's what Jesus is urging them to do or talking about doing around that table. And then the passage ends with him reminding them that he's taught them all of these things while they were together in small or large settings, with the expectation that they will recognize the activity of God and grow in faith when they stumble upon God in the future. So I don't know about you, but I think the feelings around that table might have been kind of intense. There's another translation about this passage. Eugene Peterson writes about it this way in The Message. Not the whole thing. I'm just going to read a few of his chapter or his verses. He says, "I'm telling you these things while I'm still living with you." It's up there. "The friend, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send at my request, will make everything plain to you. He will remind you of all the things I've told you. I'm leaving you well and whole. That's my parting gift to you. Peace. I won't leave you the way you're used to being left, feeling abandoned and bereft. So don't be upset. Don't be distraught." And it goes on. You can read that. So how do you hear that? Can we imagine Jesus speaking these words in a tone of voice that matches the setting of that small, intimate room? Even then, when I just read that, see, I went into reading commanding voice. I'm not sure that that's what it was like. Because I think if we can imagine it in that other way, if we can, then the poignancy of that moment, of the whole scene really, has more of a chance to work on us and to come all through those generations from that primary time into today. See, Jesus was saying that he's not going to give them peace as the world gives them peace. He's not going to leave them the way they're used to being left. Phew. Because the way the world leaves us so often, frankly, that just sucks. It's really hard. I call that the way of abandonment. That's how it's most often done when you're left behind to pick up pieces and move forward. You know, someone who's been with you daily and had your back, gone. Now it's your turn. So I think maybe despair is probably an appropriate descriptor of this scene and of this moment. Because most often that's what it's like to live in the world. And the disciples are sitting, reclining together around a table, having just had a meal. And I think maybe we could say that they're tasting one of the most human experiences now of all. Being left alone before we're ready to be left alone. Before we feel capable. Before we think we're up to it. Living a full life, you see, a really full life, often means we also have to face trauma, hardship, even loss sometimes, and that we have to find in those times and events and experiences ways to move forward anyway, ways to continue to breathe even when it feels really, really hard. And Jesus is preparing his disciples to do just that. And he's assuring them, in whatever voice you hear, that his death isn't going to be the end of God's plan to live in their world, live in the neighborhood. And that we're going to know this, they're going to know it, because they'll eventually experience peace. Not just peaceful lives, but they'll experience peace. And since I hear him offering this peace in perhaps a broken voice with I imagine, tears, a little bit at least coming down his cheeks, that helps me, and maybe it helps you too, that he knows for sure that the very parts of our world that make Jesus ache for peace, that's what we ache for too. And our tears fall when we hold that possibility, but also live and know how hard it can be. And this passage, maybe it lends hope for all of us, because maybe we now can believe in his understanding of that too. That there's a sense that we long for a lasting peace and we're crying in sorrow at the exact same time. That sounds like real life to me, not perfection in a little upper room that so often gets painted about Jesus and his disciples. When Matt and I began this worship, or when we dreamed up this worship series and we had watched all of these episodes on Netflix, we did not notice. I mean, we seriously did not notice what we now see as a recurring theme in the lives of each of these chefs. And I don't know if you've noticed it too over these weeks. Every one of these chefs achieves a great measure of worldly success, like notoriety and fame and money, fortune. And then, when they're at that place in their game, they realize that they have to step back and find their authentic voice, find their own way to continue, if they're ever to continue, in the field of work that they've given their life over to. So in a real way, it feels to us that they cry in sorrow at their own life and their own purpose, and at the same time are trying to find and pursue a lasting peace in their own way of cooking, in their own way of sourcing and finding the ingredients that are unique to their food. And this week, our chef is just the same. They call him a Kiwi chef. His name is Ben Shuri, and he's from New Zealand and has a strong Australian accent. That's how they describe him. I don't know how you tell the difference. I'm not a worldly traveler. I find him hard to understand, but at the same time, I'm intrigued. So when you do hear the videos, just relax. It's a little hard to understand his words. In 2012, a great chef of another restaurant, Momofuku, his name is David Chang, he tweeted out about Ben. He said, "Ben Shuri's potato in earth dish," that's the name of a dish on a menu, potato in earth, "was one of the best things he'd ever eaten in his life." Not long after that, in Bon Appetit magazine, you know that great magazine, the famous Danish chef, Red Zepi of Noma, and if you've watched, you know, Food Network and stuff, oh, it's an amazing restaurant. He was quoted as saying that Ben Shuri is one of the most rare of breed of chefs who cooks out of an inner desire to express himself. So I want to tell you a little bit about him because it's important to understand. Ben was born and raised on the west coast of New Zealand. And he was born in the North Island in a place called Taranaki. And his restaurant, though, is not there. It's in Melbourne, Australia, and his restaurant is called Attica. And I'll say more about that in a little bit. By all accounts, that little restaurant, Attica, is really small. It's very humble, and it's very modest. But it has made its place in the list of the top 50 restaurants of the world. Not just of Australia, but like the world. So how does that happen? Well, Ben was raised on a sprawling 2,000-acre farm. I didn't know farms could be 2,000 acres. For the first 14 years of his life. It was on that farm with his family that Ben gained his philosophy, he says, about the environment and about food. He shares that he had a mom and a dad who loved him and his sisters very, very much. And he had everything that he could want emotionally as a young child. And of this time in his life, those first 14 years, here's what he says. We had no money, but we had a great family spirit. We had food, and my father, he would slaughter animals in front of us. He would shoot a cow with a rifle, and he would skin and gut the cow right in front of us. And I remember that smell very well, and it was an early awakening for me to the reality of food and living on a farm, and what farm food was, and how farm food was actually produced. This land, he said, had so many also wild plants on it. And it had different kind of shellfish because they were on the coast. And we relied on all of those things to sustain our family. In addition, Ben's mom had a huge vegetable garden for their family. So he says, we were completely self-sufficient way before it was trendy to try and be self-sufficient. In reading articles about Ben, I learned that he grew up in that community, and that it was extremely remote. So his mom was also his school teacher. And there was one school, and it had 9 students, Ben and his 2 sisters, that's 3, and then 6 other kids. That's all that was in the area. His mom cooked in their house in a small kitchen where, when he was 8, he learned how to make this basic French white sauce. Paul helped me say it. Bechamel. Yeah, that. Okay, that's what he learned when he was 8 years old, and it's butter, milk, flour, and salt. And then you go to town after that, I guess, and then pour it over things, and it's fabulous. And he says he learned that, he wanted to learn it when he was 8, because at the age of 5, he decided to become a chef, 5 years old. And he says, I don't know how you become come to that conclusion when you live in the back country of New Zealand in a remote place. But I did when I was 5, and he'd never been in a restaurant, and that's how I set out on my life's journey. So I said Shuri was not financially rich growing up, but he had a lot of freedom in his life, and he was surrounded by nature. He said they didn't have many toys, so what they did for entertainment was to go out in the bush and build their own things, and their parents let them go out overnight. They had to forage and cook for themselves out in the wild. I can't imagine doing this, but so he and his 6-year-old sister, he said, would walk for hours and hours to go out and spend the night in the bush and make their own meals. He did this, and it formed him. And then in his teenage years, he left home. And he left New Zealand, and he went to Australia to learn, as he says, how to be a chef. And he felt that he already was, because he had learned to cook at home. And he went out, and in that process of being a young chef in his teens and early 20s, he said he forgot all about his roots. He forgot all about his relationship. with the bush. He forgot all about his relationship with the environment. And that's how it was for him until when he was 27 years old, had his first child with his wife, Natalia, and was a line cook in a restaurant that he loved under a chef who was teaching him about Thai food, and another chef who is teaching him the basics of French cooking, as all of these chefs have. But he came to this moment at 27 years old, and he said, I realize I'm a line cook, and I'm only making $600 a week, and I'm not going to make it. I have a baby now. So that is when he looked in the newspaper and decided he would try and be a head chef at a restaurant called Attica. This was not then what it is now. At that time, it was not famous. And what would eventually bring Ben into the public eye was not going to happen for years and years. And also, what ended up bringing him into the public eye was really, at first, not his cooking at all. It came from Ben assessing his own weaknesses. That's how it got to be famous. I think of it, and I put it with these disciples in this little room, because if they had not assessed their weaknesses and gone on, we wouldn't be here, right? If they had stayed in that room, we wouldn't be here. So the disciples had to succeed in great measure, or else Jesus' mission of love in the world would not. And it's not easy for them, and it wasn't easy for Ben either. So after many, many months and over a year of working in that little place, Attica, and doing his best, he said he worked over 100 hours a week. He realized, as he tried to make French food and Thai food, something was really wrong. He had taken it over to try and do something original, but he just kept producing what he knew. He served classical dishes, and he is the first, he says, to admit that it really didn't work. And the tables were empty. That's not what you want in a restaurant. So he realized that if he ever wanted to create his own style, he was going to have to move away from all of those new reference points. And where did he go? Back to New Zealand in his own mind and heart and the memories of his childhood. If that was all that was amiss, that would have been one thing, but there was something else that was deeply troubling. That working that I mentioned of 100 hours a week meant that Ben was not spending any time with his family. By this time, three kids and a wife. He says, the months were hard, and it is like we were living in a dark tunnel. That time and those years eventually began to catch up with me, he said. And these are his words. I found myself in a funk. That funk is now, I know, called depression. And I'm not ashamed to talk about it. He talks to chefs about it around the world. The greatest strength of a person, he said, I think, is to admit your weakness. I don't see depression anymore as a weakness. It was an experience in my life that I had to live through, I had to deal with, and I had to overcome it. I was, in that time, close to never cooking again. I couldn't even cook for my family. I could not get myself out of bed. And what those months taught me was that I have to live every day as if it were my last. It lasted over 8 months for him. Because every day actually could be my last, he said. And I had to look at my life differently through the eyes of my children. I had to look at how my behavior was going to affect them and my wife. And now I try to base my life around being an authentic person. And it means being born a free individual, like my dad, like my uncles, like my mom, and most of that community that had raised me that I had forgotten about. And being authentic, he realized, involves truthfulness of simple things. His origins, his roots, his inspiration for what he cooks and the things that influenced him early on. The other thing that happened right about that time, and I'm not going to go into this, you can read it online, is he met a friend, a fisherman named Lance Whiffen, who was having the exact same experience. Working over 100 hours a week in an unsustainable fashion, not seeing his family, and trying to fish and source restaurants. The two became friends. They source each other now and companions, and it so looks like our kitchen tables and living life together and how we try to watch over each other. They've been friends ever since. This is a small clip, one of two that we're going to look at, from the Netflix series where you hear someone else talking about the uniqueness. What I want you to look at is how Ben and his chefs handle these materials. And it's hard to hear, but what he's telling you is there are no recipes for these ingredients that come from his homeland. Let's watch.
What's fascinating about watching chefs like Ben is there's a hunger, a desire to try and find ways of turning them into a gastronomic culinary experience.
When we're working with native ingredients, they're very hard to harness. There's no information on the internet about them. There's no books that have recipes using them. When you're developing a dish like the kangaroo dish, you want to take it and work with it as many ways as possible. Over that time, whether it be 3 months or 2 years, you're always thinking, one day I'm going to unlock the greatness of that ingredient. I'm going to find the most delicious and most natural way of cooking with it. This is an important part of our country's heritage. Australians should have a sense of pride in these ingredients. They should know what they taste like. Because the connection to your roots is really one of the most important things of all.
Ben shifted all of his relationships with an eye towards new ingredients and unlocking the power of those ingredients, as well as harnessing him. That's a word that he uses. And one of the main ways that Ben found these ingredients was a way called foraging. I found out that that's a new word for a lot of people. I've grown up with chefs, and I know they go foraging for mushrooms, you know. So it means simply going out into the world and finding food, not the store, not farmer's market. So when Ben was trying to make this shift, he couldn't find the fresh ingredients that he needed. The greens in the market, he said, weren't good enough, so he foraged, and he remembered his historical connection to his parents, who had taught him and his sisters to survive in the wild and had taught them how to recognize what they could eat. And in Australia, the market was not able to provide him with enough. We live in California. It's very hard to break out of that sense. I mean, we can pretty much almost get anything over at the co-op or the Nugget or right at Whole Foods. We are so blessed. But Ben in Australia, and we're going to hear this next week too, is in a land where it's not like that. So, Shuri and his chefs began, and there's another picture, I think, of him with that. It's cut off, but that's his son there. And family went out on train tracks, and they went outside the restaurant into alleyways, to beaches. They eat seaweed. They went in places you wouldn't expect. But even that, because it started to work, doesn't provide enough food. So The next thing is that they needed to have a garden. Their first venture failed, but this short video shows that the land trust had always had a vision for how they could be in relationship with Attica. So let's, and it's hard to hear, but let's listen to him talk about this huge garden that they have now.
I remember walking through the garden and thinking how great it would be to be able to have a garden here. This is going back 7 years ago. And I never thought that it would be a possibility. And then one day, by chance, I met Justin Buckley, the head gardener, and we really hit it off, saw eye to eye on a lot of things. And he said that the trust had always been keen on me having a garden here, and it was kind of a funny moment, you know. A big part of wanting to have a garden was to have a greater diversity of plants and herbs that we can use in our restaurant, and also a greater connection with those plants. You know, we sow the seeds, we raise them, we weed them, we make sure they get watered. And so Justin's been an incredible friend, and also an amazing source of inspiration and knowledge, and how to set up irrigation systems, and how long to water for, and how to work the soil. And we were coming in as beginners, you know, and we've learned so much in the year that we've had it. It's a great thing. I mean, you know, it's kind of like coming over here and seeing friends when we come to Ripley Estate, you know, the gardeners and the people that work here.
It's subtle, but you hear Ben use the word we. The other real shift that he made was when he says we, he means himself and his chefs. They go together. And you saw that they're actually, those little purple flower petals go on a dish, like we're eating flower petals. And they take that great care. He says, as a cook, you want your chefs to be happy too. Because being in a dark kitchen for 12 to 15 hours a day is not a happy existence sometimes. So you want your chefs and your cooks all together to experience things outside of the world of the kitchen, to give their lives meaning and enjoyment. So that's why you hear him say they grow their own seeds and they tend their own garden and they pull their own weeds. And now in that garden that we saw, they have 18 kinds of basil. I didn't know that existed. Something called graffiti cauliflower. 150 varieties of heritage apples. 150 varieties of apples. And 5 varieties of different pear trees, he said. We grow all of our own vegetables, and we, and doing has created even a deeper appreciation of our ingredients that we try to use every part of the plant. That's why we see them do this and this. To unlock the greatness of the ingredients of God's love, I think it looks a little bit like that. To live on this side of Easter, to taste resurrection, even when our hearts are challenged or depressed or feel troubled, even when we, like those first followers of Jesus, have feelings of despair and we're not totally certain what our next step is supposed to be, we, like Ben, who doesn't claim to follow Jesus, but I still think we can learn from his life, we, like Ben, can choose to go to our roots, to go and live in the hope that we find in keeping Jesus' words of, I'm leaving you well and whole. That's my parting gift to you, he said, peace. I don't leave you the way you're used to being left, feeling abandoned and bereft. So don't be upset. Don't be distraught. And I don't mean in any way to oversimplify Ben's shift or to claim him as just a quick person who was depressed for a minute. Depression is real, and when it's treated and managed, though, life can taste sweet again, and that's what we can learn from him. And I think he points to this peace. And I think also part of how I came to a listening is, if you look at his face, can we see that first picture again? He's such a gentle man. Every video you watch of him is like how we heard him. He just loves food and moves gently and lovingly in this world, connecting with his roots and urging his diners in his still very small restaurant to do the same. And one of the things that they do there now is they close the restaurant for a while so that their workers can have a life. So our call and our wondering is, when we connect to our roots, when we come to this place and you hear us say, we come to root our lives in grace, will we also be able to move from this place into the world, out of our kitchen here, to love all those whom God calls beloved? Can we find ways to move out of this, our kitchen, into the world to serve those who are our enemies? Will our ingredients of following Jesus, of rooting our lives in grace and growing in faith and reaching in love, give us the tools we need? That's our hope, to extend hospitality to all those who want it, need it, seem different, difficult. There's some strange people that God has created. Some of us in this room. How do you hear Jesus' words this morning? I don't know about you, but I, in this, feel and hear a little bit of tremulous in his voice. A little bit of vulnerable hope on his behalf that maybe we're going to get it. We know the disciples got it, or we wouldn't be here. So now it's our turn. And if nothing else, maybe our next step, for many of us, some for the first time, but many for the millionth time, is to come to this table, to root our lives in grace through the sharing of the breaking of the bread and the cup that Jesus offers. Let's prepare to do that now.
I am set free, oh, I am set free.